You're listening to the podcast for Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Buy tickets to upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org. Want even more Inforum? Find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as InforumSF. And now I would actually really like to introduce Julie first to introduce a performance for this evening. Julie.
Thank you.
Go, Julie.
Thank you, Marissa. Thank you so much. Thank you, Marissa. Thank you, Inforum and the Commonwealth Club. I live here. This is my community. I've been on the road with this book now for about 2 weeks. And toward the end of, you know, the 10-day journey back east, I just thought, just get me through to the Commonwealth Club. Just get me through to the Commonwealth Club. Because being in community with my community is ballast and nourishment as I share these words and these thoughts with strangers. I decided that with Real American, which is a memoir on my journey with respect to race and racism and feeling like the other, that while I'm given a microphone, you know, and I have an audience and, you know, an amazing institution supporting me and an amazing person to be in conversation with, my friend, LaDoris Cordell, I want to step aside for a moment. Before I do my thing, at every stop on the Real American book tour, I've asked the local community to select a young writer, poet, spoken word artist, to come and take the stage before me. It is my way of saying I want to share my privilege with people who are coming up behind me. And so, yeah. So I am thrilled to introduce to you Jada Imani. Jada is an MC, Youth Speak's emerging poet mentor, nonviolence practitioner, and co-founder of Tattoo Vision. She works toward a vision of regenerative communities through her performance and healing arts. Jada builds coalitions with communities of poets, hip-hop heads, entrepreneurs, and permaculturalists alike. She curates and hosts at least two events on behalf of Tattoo Vision each month. These events are always intentional, donation-based, and for all ages. Please welcome to the stage Jada Imani.
Peace, everybody. How are you feeling? Good. You know what I loved? Hearing Julie speak, and at one point y'all said, you know, that's how you know when it's like received and resonates. Feel free to keep that going. Y'all know about the snaps too. Cool, let's get into this. I am black, SpongeBob yellow, gap teeth, post braces, laughter, yearning for itself, solitude, yearning for itself. During an equinox, I will be turquoise, for when the sun skinny dips into the blue of winter, I will be the day the world ends, reminiscing. Both emerging from and clinging to history of life in my skin. I am heart. I will be love again. The day the world ends, there will be another surge of the scramble for Africa as the buried blacker berries emerge from the ground to say backer, back, backer, as snowflakes scurry. By then, I will be warrior through sun salutations. I was the first snowflake to dissolve into dirt, to turn into mud. I was molded against my will. I am claiming reparations.
And now please welcome Julie Lithcott-Hames and Judge LaDoris Cordell.
Okay, here we go. Wow. Good evening. All right. This is great. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to tonight's program with Inforum at the Commonwealth Club. I am LaDoris Cordell, and it's my pleasure to be in conversation with Julie Lithcott-Hames. Julie is a woman of many talents. She has earned both her JD and an MFA. She served as Stanford's Dean of Freshmen. And she wrote the New York Times bestseller and anti-helicopter parenting manifesto, How to Raise an Adult. So we're here today to talk about her memoir, Real American. In Real American, she writes beautifully about, in her own words, the thousand small cuts racism imposes on African Americans, and her experience as a biracial woman in America. So there's lots to discuss, and we're going to get right started. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you for being here. Thank you for doing this, Ladoris.
It's my pleasure.
It is a joy to be here with you.
It is my pleasure. We go back a long ways.
We do.
This is good.
Yeah.
So, Julie, the New York Times has a video program, and recently they released another video, and it's called Being Biracial, : A Choice, Luxury, or Delusion?
Mm.
What is it for you?
Mm. When the term biracial came out in the late 1980s, I clung to it. I sought to bring it within me to internalize it. I write as it felt as if it was like getting an organ transplant, because I'd been told all my life, you are black, and yet I have this really light skin and this voice and this hair. I never seemed to be black enough for the black community. I certainly wasn't white. And so when biracial was offered, I said, yes, I finally don't have to deny the existence of my white mother, who happens to be here today. And yet, I go on to say, it was a fleeting lover, because I finally began, as I grew to love myself as a black woman, and found a sense of belonging within the black community, despite the things that might alienate me from it, I was able to claim black. And to describe myself as biracial really as a fact of my ancestry, but no longer the way I identify. So, yeah, that's my answer. I'm trying to be succinct tonight.
It's all right. So Julie, why write this book? Was there an event, a moment when something happened that made you think, okay, I need to do this?
I was doing the MFA to try to be a better writer, to write that anti-helicopter parenting book. And every time I wasn't writing the anti-helicopter parenting book, race kept coming up in my poetry classes, in my playwriting classes, in my creative nonfiction classes. These memories that I had buried or that had squirreled themselves into me were asking for my conscious attention. And so I guess I had loved myself to the point of self-acceptance as a black woman. And once I was embracing my own self in this body, in this being, then I could tell the truth of what my experience had been instead of pretending all of those things hadn't happened.
So this book, this is a book, and by the way, I love this photo. It's a great photo.
Yes. My mom took it.
It's a lovely photo. How old were you in this photo?
About 15, 16 months.
And where was this taken?
We lived in Lagos, Nigeria. I was born in Lagos, Nigeria, to a British mom and an African-American dad. And we were about to move to Manhattan, to the States. But mom captured this in our backyard in Lagos.
Wow. I love the photo. So, Julie, this is a book about race, a subject about which we'll talk about in a little bit. But this book also raises the question, are you an American? So the 2016 election made it clear that there isn't universal agreement on what it means to be an American. A recent survey by the Democracy Fund found that across party lines, we're talking just the two major parties, well over half the people surveyed agreed that respecting political institutions and laws, having citizenship and accepting people of diverse backgrounds are essential to calling yourself an American. And the survey showed divides between parties. The most significant disagreements about who is an American centered on the importance of living in America for most of one's life, being born in America, and being a Christian. And among those surveyed, Trump supporters felt the strongest about these factors. Yeah. So what, in your view, is a real American?
I think it's a term that applies to all of us or none of us. I think it's a fiction. I chose it because I was tired of those right-wing politicians saying, real Americans deserve this, right? Real Americans want that. And I knew they weren't talking about us and many of us. And I thought, God damn it. I mean, can I say that here at Inforum? Like, I'm a real American. Like, shut up. Stop trying to carve a line, you know, along racial lines and call yourselves real Americans and say the rest of us don't belong. We are as entitled to be here as any of the rest of you. And so stop it. Okay. But I also use this term because my slave ancestor, Sylvie, who lived in Charleston, South Carolina in the late 1700s and was raped by her master.
Right.
And that act is the reason I exist. She made me a real American. She was here on this soil. She was in Charleston, the harbor town through which one in two African slaves were brought. They didn't consider her a human being. But she made me a real American. So this is sort of a, ain't I a real American? I mean, I try to channel Sojourner Truth in here. Ain't I a woman? Ain't I a real American? My people go all the way back. My people built this country. You know, we have not even begun to scratch the surface of what we owe African Americans by way of recompense for all that has been done by us, against us. And so I am trying to say, if I'm not a real American, nobody is, you know, and I actually believe we all are.
Okay, Julie. So, Julie, do you think that most biracial individuals question their Americanness? Do you think they see themselves as real Americans? I know you can't speak for all biracial people, but from your experience, do you think there is that questioning?
So I need to mention my age. I'm about to be 50. My parents, right? Right on, exactly. Woohoo, 50. I see you, Gen X.
50 is the new 30. I have to tell you that because I'm soon to be 70. 70 is the new 50.
Exactly. Right. Woo. Okay. I acknowledge my age because times have changed. When I was born in 1967 to a black man and a white woman, there was no term biracial, as I've said. Loving versus Virginia, declaring my parents' marriage legal, you know, and invalidating laws in 17 states that said my parents should not marry, should not have sex and bear children, you know, that was all happening around the time of my birth. So the population of mixed race children began to grow as our parents' unions became okay in the eyes of the American government in the various states. So now we have a burgeoning multiracial mixed race population, and I don't pretend to know what their experience has been. I grew up in a time where to be me was to be odd, was to be exotic, or to be treated like a zoo animal. What are you? She's your mother? You know, where are you from? Like, what is that hair? You know, I was an oddity, and I think these days, because of the multiplicity of intermixtures, the various intersectionalities, particularly in our community, to be a mixed race person today is to have a markedly different experience than I had coming up in the 70s and early 80s. I hope biracial or multiracial people today feel very American. It is a very American construct. We are the embodiment of, in some ways, America's ideals about anyone can come here and anyone can be here and live freely and fall in love and do what you will. And people do what you will and it ends up with mixed race people sometimes. You know, I hope it's easier for people today, and I think it is.
Wow. You write beautifully and honestly about your relationship with your mom. Near the end of the book, you write, and I quote, "It comes time to address things with my mother. She is 77, still strong but more tired now, still very self-reliant, and so frustrated when ready, and still beautiful. In my kitchen one day, I speak to her pointedly with the voice of a woman no longer afraid to confront her past, her accuser, her accused. How could you choose to live in Verona? How dare you chide me for not having black friends when you raised me in an all-white town? She looks at me and begins to cry. So, Julie, what happened?
That's our favorite part of the book. No. The joke. My mother and I are in anguish listening to what I've decided to put on page whatever.
We're
going to
dig deep here. Yeah. So what happened? Why did you confront your mom? Did you blame her for something? And if so, for what? And what has been your mom's reaction to the book?
I love you. I know you do. My mother, when I began drafting this book, never said you didn't have these experiences, never said you shouldn't write this book. She said, I'm happy for you that you have come to a place where you can contend with what your life has been like to date and that you're writing about it. I was yelling at my mom because as I came to terms with this upbringing, I was angry about some things. But I was yelling at my mom because my daddy has been gone for 22 years. I didn't have the ability to interrogate him about any of this stuff. My mom's the parent who is still with us. And so in some ways, I took it all out on her when daddy surely shouldered more than half of the responsibility because he was the man in a fairly traditionally gendered marriage. He was the African-American parent, and he made a lot of those decisions. The decision about where to plunk me down for high school in an all-white town was his. And before he died, I just didn't have the wherewithal to yell at him, why did you move me to an all-white town? Didn't I deserve... He said to me at one point in high school, white boys will be your friend but never date you. Well, my high school was 1,200 white people and me. So, but I couldn't say to my beloved daddy, then why did you move me here? Don't I deserve love? Don't I deserve to be in relationship? Like, what is that? So mom, unfortunately, being the parent who's here and very much in my life, we all live in one home together. That's how we afford to live here. She took it. And I so appreciate the fact that you let me say what I needed to say.
I will tell you, Julie, that, and all of you know this, a memoir is not worth the paper it's written on if it's not brutally honest and truthful. And that's certainly what this memoir is.
And LaDoris Cordell just quoted herself. She's one of the people who blurbed my book, which I'm so grateful to you for. And she said exactly that.
So about your father, you write this. Daddy was an anarchist, some might say, a prankster, a subversive, a rule breaker, some would say a thug. He was a man of great intellect, tall and strong, still subject to being called boy by any white man at any moment. So, Julie, your dad, he wasn't, as you said, too keen on your dating white boys. Did it seem hypocritical to you since he had married a white woman? So just tell us about your dad and about that, if you can.
All okay, right. Your daddy was born in 1918. Do the math. If he had lived to this day, he would turn 100 in April. So that's my way of sharing with you that he grew up in a different time. He grew up in the Jim Crow South in Oklahoma. He had a very, very different experience from mine. I forget the question you asked me about.
So my question was, he didn't want you to date
right.
white boys,
you know,
but yet he married
all right.
white
he
boys.
Wasn't saying he didn't want me to date them. He was saying, baby, white boys will be your friend, but they'll never date you. He wasn't saying, well, maybe he was. He loved my mother and yet had really rigid views about whites and blacks. I think maybe he thought mom was an anomaly among white folk. I think so. She's saying, you know, I think he moved me to an all-white town because it was the nicer house and a school that they felt was right for me. They were trying to give me opportunity. And he had overlooked what that might do to my psychosocial development as an adolescent, not being around people who might be willing to date me or might be able to console me when shit happened.
So your dad, though, grew up Jim Crow. There were things that happened to him that were not good, racist things. So was he angry?
He told me very few stories about his past. He was 77 when he died. I was 27. And I think there is so much we don't know about our own parents until we are old enough to know ourselves well enough to really be interested in their story. So I heard the occasional funny story. I knew that he didn't like the 4th of July, but I knew that from my mother. He never spoke of it. And it was my mom who sort of informed me with her sort of nodding head and sideways looks, you know, the 4th of July, you know, is about daddy and his blackness and his past. So I gleaned that there were elements of being black in America that had wounded daddy so deeply that he couldn't speak of it.
Would he have applauded Kaepernick for taking a
knee? He would. And I do. Absolutely. Yes. You know, and he would have applauded Barack Obama. How I wished he had been alive to see Barack Obama elected president. You know, and yet, there, as much as I miss my daddy, there have been times as Barack Obama became increasingly disrespected in pockets of white America, you know, as Trump rose to power, there have been times when I've been grateful he did not live to see these backslides and these turns, because he was of an era and of a generation where so much progress was made. And the thought of having to be in conversation with my daddy now about the state of things brings me to tears. And you know, I'm glad he did not have to experience what we're experiencing now.
So, Julie, if we look at it just kind of superficially, right? You are half black and half white. Yet you write the following: "No, I was never white. I am not white because whites do not see, will never see me as one of them, and because I do not want to be." So, that means you're black, right? So if you're biracial, I'm confused. So unconfuse me.
Y'all have studied the one-drop rule. One of America's earliest rules was that black is a stain and whiteness is pure. So if you have one drop of black blood, it went, then you are black. You know, and this is why, this is how they perpetuated the population of slaves. The slaves were raped by their masters and gave birth to lighter children, and lighter children, how to keep those children enslaved was to invent this one-drop rule. That rule goes all the way back in time, centuries and centuries ago, but the fact of it is with us today. When you are a black man walking down the street trying to hail a cab, your cabbie doesn't know that you've got a white mama. If your skin is brown, is my color brown and darker, you are treated as a black person in this country. You know, the black experience is an experience of being second or third class in many respects in this country. And so the fact of your ancestry, that you might have a white parent or, you know, a white grandparent or what have you, you know, that doesn't have anything to do with how you're treated when you walk into a store or walk down the street or you're on an elevator and so on. And that is, you know, that is the reality of being a person of color, of being a brown-skinned person in America.
Your spouse, Dan, is white and Jewish. You have a biracial son and a biracial daughter. And of the
and they're all here.
They are here, sitting here in the front. And of the two, you write that, of the two children, your son, Sawyer, you talk about him having, and again, we're just talking skin color, some brownness, right? Have you and Dan had the talk with Sawyer? And how is he faring in America?
So my our beautiful son, Sawyer, and beautiful daughter, Avery, are here, 18-year-old, 16-year-old, yes. Right? And my husband, whom I adore, who loved me and my black hair before I did. We've been together 30 years, and I'm grateful for you every day. Yes, we have had the talk with Sawyer. And for those of you who may not know what the talk is what We parents of black children, particularly black boys, say to them to prepare them as they prepare to go out into America, as they prepare to leave our homes and leave our neighborhoods and move out beyond whatever cushion of safety that may feel to be, particularly if we're upper middle class and we live in communities where we think we've sort of passed into some status where they're protected. You know, we know actually that they are not necessarily protected and safe in those communities, Trayvon Martin being the most excruciating recent example. And so we have the talk, which is, hey, son, sweetheart, you're heading out tonight. Want to remind you how to conduct yourself if and when something goes down, if and when you're in a car that gets pulled over, if and when you're in a group where something has gone down. Those of you with darker skin may be regarded as the problem, as the perpetrator, as the problem maker. And so the excruciating aspect of this is we're trying to teach them to be safe and smart and protect themselves. You know, it flies in the face, though, of the other message we're trying to send, which is you are beautiful and you matter and you belong here. So we have to do this really careful dance, which is prepare them to be smart and safe and yet not undercut their opportunity for self-love and self-acceptance.
That's a hard thing.
It is an incredibly hard thing to do. And I think that the part that for me brings anguish is their innocence. Is robbed so much earlier than I think the innocence of children generally is, because at some point they move from being these adorable black and brown boys to becoming thugs in some people's eyes. You know, and I write about this. You know, you transition before white eyes into thugs. They're still our sons. They're still our family. They're still adored by us, but the American narrative, the American racist narrative says, aha, but now they are men of color. And the racist narrative then attaches its hooks into them and says, presumed guilty, bad, thug, criminal, not deserving of mercy, not presumed innocent, etc.
So about your beautiful daughter, Avery, you wrote this: I brace for some white person to ask if I am her nanny. Tell us about that.
So you can't see my beloved children. I can. You know, they look like a mixture of me and Dan. I think to the world, Avery looks more like Dan, and to the world, Sawyer looks more like me. Who knows? The Bay Area is such a place of consciousness around race and intersectionality. Who knows? But I know there are times when Avery has been asked, she's your mother? Just like I was asked, she with a white mother, right? So there are white folks who look at me and think Avery and I don't match, which breaks my heart. Or they'll see her with her arm around this cute boy, and they'll say, who's he? Are you dating him? She's like, he's my brother. And then they say, he's your brother? So Avery, with lighter skin and hair that is a looser curl than mine, has been told across her 16 years she doesn't match a couple members of her family. I worried that somebody would ask me if I was her nanny. It didn't happen. It didn't happen. I'm glad it didn't happen. I know plenty of people to whom it has happened.
You're listening to a podcast of Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Support our podcast and find out about upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org.
Insults, the intended and the unintended, are what just about every black person in America has suffered. And I have a long list of them. Yeah. Let me give you just one example. For me, the terrifying moment when I was stopped in my car in Palo Alto by the police, held at gunpoint, put up against a wall, suspected of being involved in an armed robbery that witnesses reported involved three black men on foot. I was in my car. And this was shortly after I had just been sworn in to the California Bar, a Stanford Law graduate. You've had your share of racial insults, intended and unintended. You write about them honestly, painfully in the book. And can you give us a few examples?
Sure. In my all-white high school, 1,200 kids, Middleton, Wisconsin, I am student body president. I'm on the pom-pom team. I'm in the concert choir. I'm doing very well in my classes.
Pom-pom team?
Pom-pom. I know.
All right. All right.
Yay. I know. Youth. And on my 17th birthday, I was feeling incredibly beautiful that day. I had the wool dress, the black dress with the shoulder pads. It was the 80s, and I had the heels, the pumps, and the lipstick, and the hair all smooth, smooth, smooth. I used to press my hair to try to make it look like the white girl's hair. And somebody wrote the N-word on my locker that day on my birthday three times on this beautiful locker sign my best friend had gone to such trouble to make for me. And I didn't tell anybody. I was so ashamed. I was so embarrassed. I desperately did not want anyone to know. I just crossed out the words, found a black marker, crossed out the words, took the sign home, cut the words out, and put it in my scrapbook where it remains to this day, you know, as part of the recorded history of my childhood. The truth of that was I felt like the N-word of my town. I felt that I'd been sort of called out. And then I think I was 17, it was my 17th birthday, I think I spent the next 20 to 22, 25 years trying never to be called that word again, which meant trying to perform myself in a way that would not incur that response from whites. So try to be the black person they didn't loathe, fear, or disregard, and to sort of make it with white people, which required a real subjugation of, you know, my sense of self and my self-love as an African American. You know, much less weighty things, but more frequent were the sort of exotifying, the sort of touching my hair and the, oh my gosh, I'm so fascinated, you know, your hair, it's so amazing, and just touching me. And
let me interrupt 1 second. Mm. What would you tell Sawyer and Avery today if someone had written, and I by the way, I don't like this whole N-word, I just say, if someone had written nigger on the locker, what would you tell them to do today? What you did, or?
Well, I hope that I have a relationship with them where they would tell me first, and Dan. I didn't feel that I could tell my parents. I didn't want them to worry that I wasn't okay. But we didn't do a lot of talking about race and racism in our family. Times are different now, and I have tried to make it much safer to have those conversations in our house. So I hope they would tell me, as we parents all hope, when a child experiences something horrendous and horrific, that they would feel safe telling it at home. I would want them also to tell the school. The me now would march down the hallway of my high school and say to those people, you have a problem at this school, and here's what it looks like.
That's what
are you going to do about it?
That's
right?
Exactly what I'm talking about.
Right?
Right.
But, right. And I hope my children have a strong enough sense of self that they could do that. And if they couldn't do it on their own, then I would flank them and go do it with them.
Tell us about another incident you wrote in the book. You went to, was that a Halloween party or something?
In Palo Alto.
Yes. Tell about that. It's in the book.
Palo Alto is getting extra mention in this conversation.
Well.
It's a fundraiser for the Palo Alto, for the school our kids attend, the elementary school. It was maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And it's a murder mystery party. You know, one of these things you sign up for, okay, I'll pay the money, I'll sign up, I'll go to the party, right? It's a murder mystery party. And the setting is athletes have been marooned on a desert, on a desert island. And certain people have been assigned parts. There are about 50 people. Dan and I go to the party to help. We've signed up to work the party, okay? We're helping the hosts bring the food out and set up the drinks and so on.
Can you describe the hosts? They are
A German expat couple, Germans who are here working in the U.S. for a short time, white folks, German. And our community is largely white and Asian, and very, very few blacks, a handful of Latino families, one Native American family that I happen to know, maybe more. And so we're at this party. It's the music is turned up. There are tiki torches and you know, candles floating in the pool, and there's food, and the music gets turned up, and this woman comes around the side of the house to the party in blackface. She is dressed head to toe in blackface, and I have this moment of feeling like I am drowning. Like, I can't believe what I'm seeing. I'm not seeing what I'm seeing. I can't be seeing. This can't be happening. This is happening. And that's sort of how I describe it in the book. And, you know, and she just joins a group, and people are laughing, and they start dancing, and then there's this guy in this wig, white guy wearing an Afro wig. Probably looked kind of like that Afro you and Steven had back in. Ladoris went to college with my big brother Steven back at Antioch in the 70s when big Afros were the thing.
Huge.
Well, this man is in this. He's this white guy in this Afro wig, and he comes to the center of the dancers, and someone shouts, "Show us your jive dancing." And then he starts to kind of pantomime and mimic jive dancing in his view. And I watch these neighbors, some friends, laugh. They're drinking. They're hooting it up. I feel that I'm at a frat party. I feel, you know, I feel cotton mouth. I can't believe this is happening. I feel unsafe. I want to turn off the music. I want to say to these people, what the fuck are you doing? And instead, I worry that they don't know me. They don't know me enough to respect me. They're already doing this and I'm here. So instead of saying anything, I left. I grabbed Dan's hand and we left. And then I wrote the principal and I wrote the lady, I didn't write the lady. I started telling a few people, like, can you believe this happened? You know, so appealing to some of the people who'd been there. You know, the Native American professor, Matt Snipp, Stanford, was there. And he said, "Julie, I know, I can't believe it happened either. What should we do?" We began to brainstorm. Word got out. The blackface lady got wind of the fact that I had been offended. So I got one of those emails, "Sorry if you were offended," right? So all I did was Google blackface, and I sent her the link.
There you go.
And she came to my door and apologized in person, which was good. But I made a point of, you know, in my head then I thought, I'm never going to a party thrown by white folks. I don't know well, because you know what? I felt like I was seeing unleashed whiteness. You know, it was like, this is how they behave when we're not around. Is this how they behave? You know, like, this is funny to them. It is not funny to me.
Yeah, it's sort of reminiscent. I don't know if you've all seen the Eddie Murphy thing where he does he gets white face, and then he goes only where white people are to see how they really are when we're not around. And mm-hmm. It's the same kind of thing. It's hilarious. Mm-hmm. On YouTube. All right, hair is a favorite subject of mine, as it is of yours. And you write in the book.
Yeah.
"I did not learn for decades that hair is a psychological barometer for black girls and women. It's alternatively our pride or the bane of our existence as we try to locate a sense of self within Western norms of beauty, respond to definitions of neat and tidy and professional, and bear up under humid weather." Great way with words, Julie.
Thank you.
Julie.
Thank you.
So how did your mom handle the hair thing when you were growing up, and how did you handle your hair as a teen and as an adult?
Because the population of biracial kids was really quite small, you know, Madison Avenue and hair care products weren't catering to biracials, even within the black community. I think, you know, we didn't really know what to do with hair like this. So the creams, the leave-in conditioners that exist today were not around then, and they certainly didn't exist in my neighborhood. My mother did the best she could. She would pull the brush through my hair with, you know, I had a little afro, you know, when I was little, and then about fourth grade, I wanted hair that looked more like my friends in these white towns, you know, started to want to grow it longer, kind of tame it, tamp it down, you know, put in ponytails with, try to make it ringlet or big ponytail at the back. But we didn't have the products. So my hair was just frizzy. It was fuzzy everywhere. And I felt like in retrospect, the image that I have is that it was like a tumbleweed, you know, just sort of frizzy, fuzzy. And then as a teenager, I just tried desperately, you know, I was trying to be attractive to, you know, the boys in my school, and they, you know, they teased me. The boys, I say in the book that I fantasized about at night. I know that's hard for my kids to hear. Like, they don't want to know that. But, like, they're teenagers, right? Just, like, you have a crush. You know, you want to be attractive. Those boys called me Bozo the Clown, looking at my hair. Because it would rise. You know, I'd curling iron it down, you know, try to just get it flat and get it straight. I mean, Farrah Fawcett, right? It was like my white friends had the flippy hair, and I just wanted the flippy hair. I wanted the hair that I could just, you know, do something with. And I would curling iron it straight, and then the humidity would just make it rise like a poof, you know, right? Right on. Jada's like, yeah. Okay, so, yeah. It took a while to locate the products.
But the taunting you had... So the taunting, was it, I mean, was it right to your face, or did you hear it kind of...
No, it was to my face.
Really?
Yeah, no, it was, it was to my face. It was to my face. And I actually use hair in some ways as a motif in this book. I mean, as you read this book, if you read this book, and I hope you'll read this book, I chart my own sense of self. As my sense of self and ability to love my black self strengthens, I become someone who can wear her hair the way God made it. You know, I become someone who loves the hair I have instead of trying to make it look like someone else's hair. So the hair becomes, my ability to wear this hair at the workplace, you know, becomes a statement of self-love, a statement of I am here, I belong here, and I'm not trying to please you any longer.
All the hair.
Yeah. So this will come as a surprise, I think, to many people who haven't read the book. Certainly surprised me. You dabbled for a bit in Mormonism.
Oh my God, Doris!
I was surprised. So the question is: was that a part of your journey to becoming a real American? It's in the book.
It's in the book.
It's in the book.
She's read the book 3 times.
That's right.
And I'm regretting it right now. I think the people who've only read it once did not stumble on that part. But boy, what a stumble
it
was for me.
It is interesting.
No, here's interesting. Okay, so here's why. When I was 7, I'm going to try to tell this quickly.
No,
when I was 7, we lived in New York. My mother was doing her best to raise a black child, as the advice went, right? Not biracial. We didn't have that black child. She would say, my white mother, we are a black family. She was doing her best. She was the blackest white lady I knew. And, okay, and was really, you know, talking to me about Nikki Giovanni's Spin a Soft Black Song and giving me The Snowy Day, right? The first children's book to have a black child on the cover. And she could say Antasaki Shange, you know, with flair and gusto, you know, names that made white folks go, what? Because my mother had lived in West Africa for 7 years. She met my dad in Ghana and had me in Nigeria. So mom is doing her best to represent. So the doorbell rings. I'm 7. My mom, I can feel her concern and anger start to rise. I recognize that in my mother. She walks to the door with sort of a march. I'm walking behind her, who's at the door. There are Mormon missionaries on the other side of the door, and they say their spiel, and my mother says, I don't think you have anything for us. We're a black family. And the Mormon missionaries agreed with her and turned around and left. So I knew in that moment that something was up with the Mormons and that being a black family was problematic. So as fate would offer it to me, one of the white boys in my high school who I had a crush on and who had a crush on me was a Mormon guy. I call him Mark in the book. Nice guy, very conservative, made for fiery passionate debates between us and other things. And... And I loved him, and I knew this was a church that, you know, it's not a 1 hour on Sundays church. It's a 24/7 church. And I had my mother, you know, my mom was like, you know, hated the Mormons, and his family was nice to me. And my family was not very tolerant of them. And that's because the Mormon church had a policy until 1978, that black men couldn't be priests because God had cursed a tribe of people with a skin of blackness. It's in the Book of Mormon. So, and they had a revelation in 1978 that now it's okay for blacks to be priests as they were trying to make their way into Africa and Latin America. God gave them this revelation. Okay? So this is 5 years after God decided black men were okay, right, that I am now enveloping myself in the arms of a Mormon. My mother is incensed, but I'm a teenager. I'm a teenager and my mother's being incensed makes me want to go, oh yeah, right. You know, you want to stop me? So I then, you know, I'm trying to be my own self in this family, this very liberal family, telling me what I can do and can't do. My mom says to me, you'll convert to that church over my dead body. So what did I say? Try and stop me. And so I did. I went to college. I came out to Stanford. They had a Mormon church 20 minutes away. I went and took the lessons. I stopped reading the Book of Mormon on the page 66 that says, "Cursed with the skin of darkness." But I was sort of impelled forward, you know, as a 19-year-old, 20-year-old. I joined the church. I was baptized. I told my family 8 months later at Christmas when they were all gathered, this whole family where I'm the youngest, you know, and they've all had so much more attention than me, and they matter more, they have all their issues and their problems, and I'm just the straight-A kid. And I told them all at Christmas dinner or a Christmas Eve dinner that I had joined the Mormon church. And as I say in the church, I am on an island. I am alone on this island. My family abandoned me on this island, and I will not be judged. And my saying to them, "I've joined the Mormon church," was my way to just draw a line and say, you know, like, I am here. You know, stop trying to tell me what to be. And then I had a really religious experience at the church a month later where I had this sense that I was going to be called to give a testimony at a testimony meeting. And I knew that I had had a false conversion. And I was terrified. And I waited in that service. Please, God, don't let them call me. Praying, you know, and they call one person, whew, they call the second person, whew, they call the third person, and I have eluded capture, you know, and finally the service ends and I'm leaving with glee. Thank God they didn't call me. And the bishop stops me and he says, "Julie, you were next, you know." And I said, I know. And I did know. There was something in me that said, "You're about to be called to give your testimony." And it terrified me. So I never went back. And I left the church, and that's a church you have to really leave. You have to say, "I'm leaving." You have put it in writing. And with, you know, if there are any Mormons in the room, I'm not trying to make fun of your religion. It was a bad choice for me. It was a bad, it was a evidence of my self-loathing as a black person that I could join a church that had been so hostile to black people for so long.
Wow. In 5 minutes, we're going to take your questions for Julie. So
see, it was a long answer.
I want you to start thinking about your questions. And there's a microphone in the back right there. Marissa's waving her hand. Okay, so you feel free to line up. So in 5 minutes, we'll take your questions. So you said that Dan, your spouse, is Jewish. Have you converted to Judaism?
Dan is an atheist. Boy, it's all coming out now. Like, we might as well tell you our social security numbers. Don't worry, we won't. Dan is not religious. I respect religion. I pray. I'm not a part of organized religion. But no, Dan did not ask me to convert.
Julie, what is your take on the Black Lives Matter movement?
I think we're at such an important moment in our time in this country as black people. We say Black Lives Matter. I say Black Lives Matter. I write Black Lives Matter to say black lives ought to matter to America. You know, we're not trying to say, and the fact that it's been co-opted by people who say, you know, all lives matter. It's like, come on. You know, when Hurricane Maria hits Puerto Rico, you know, that's not the time to say, oh, like everyone who's ever been hit by a hurricane matters, right? Those people are hurting right now. You don't try to generalize it. You ignore the specific pain when you do that. It's like they think we're saying we're black supremacists, Black Lives Matter. We're not black supremacists. We're not. We're saying we matter too. Our lives ought to matter as much as white lives do, and they don't. And we're fighting for that to be one day true. And we're doing it in response to the video evidence of what happens on the streets of America to black people, black men and women, particularly at the hands of law enforcement.
Well, you spent a good deal of your time as an administrator at Stanford.
With you.
It's true. You became known as Dean Julie, Dean of the Freshmen. You write in your book that something happened at Stanford where there was a program, I don't know if it was the black graduation, I'm not sure, but something happened that you were okay with you, okay with everything. So
as is the case on a number of campuses, on schools that have a decent critical mass of black students, there's the main graduation ceremony for everybody and a graduation ceremony preceding it in the black community where students are presented with kente cloth, which is cloth of the Ashanti people from Ghana, often embroidered with the name of the school or the class year, and Stanford does that. And I didn't go to my own black grad, we call it, when I was a student, because I didn't feel black enough, because I had a white mother, because I have this light skin and so on. I didn't feel a connection to the black community as a student at Stanford in the 80s. But by the time I'm now a dean, I'm being invited to come and sit on the stage with the faculty and with the staff who are black and support our graduates. And I was scared because I worried, am I... You know, do I belong here still? I was still sort of going through these contortions of, you know, will I find acceptance in the black community? Scared isn't the right word, but I just mean apprehensive. Like, do I as a light-skinned black person belong here? So I'm sitting on the stage and I'm watching the graduates cross, and this graduate comes this way and the parents come this way, and, you know, the parents present the kente cloth as kind of a hooding ceremony, if you will. And I watch a Nigerian couple come past and in their silk fabrics, and I have this memory from Nigeria. I was born there and the Nigerians were the first people I knew, and 1,000 people are thunderously applauding the Nigerian couple, you know, hooding their black child. And then this elderly single woman comes, dark-skinned single woman. She greets whom I presume is her grandson. She's that old. He's that young. I presume that. Everybody's wildly applauding, the whole audience. And then this white woman and black man come to the stage, and this caramel child comes to the stage, and I'm so worried for them. Will they be met with applause? They looked like my family, my parents and me. And they came to the stage and the people applauded wildly. And it was my first sense, this wild, loving embrace from 1,000 black folks, that people like me belong. You know, I'm crying a fraction right now of what I cried on the stage that night. People were handing me handkerchiefs. I mean, I was like, you know, like I was just...
It just brought it all like home for you, didn't it?
It was like a baptism. You know, it was religious. I felt this sense of embrace of the black community and of my white mother that I wasn't sure until that point was there. Wow. And then it was like everything changed. Wow. It was like everything changed. Yeah. I felt a sense of belonging in the black community that I had never, ever felt in any other community. So I finally felt sort of like called home. You know, I felt, I had felt, you know, like a motherless child, not a motherless child. I have an amazing mother, but within blackness, sure. I finally felt that embrace.
It's so interesting, from not being comfortable enough to go to your own black graduation, yeah. And then here it is.
Yeah.
All came around, came full circle.
Yeah.
What has been the reaction of your children and your spouse to this book?
I don't know. What do you guys think? Thank you. Sawyer just shouted, "I love it," which I appreciate. He's home from college on break, and he's diving into the book, which I love. I know Dan cries every time he rereads a draft, every time he hears me talk. I remember when I shared a draft with Avery, and I kind of just flagged all the parts she was in, you know, because I just wanted to, like, I want you to know this is what I'm saying. Is it accurate? Are you okay with it? That kind of thing. And I remembered watching, you know, Avery was reading it in our living room, in our open, you know, one big room at the bottom of the house. And there she is. And I'm keeping my distance. I'm in the kitchen, but I'm looking over at her, trying to see, like, what page is she on? How's this going? And I watch Avery experiencing emotion. And comes to me with tears and said, you know, "I'm sorry it was so hard for you, Mom," something like that. You know, such empathy. So I think they're feeling good.
What about Dan?
What about Dan?
Yeah.
Dan is, Dan supports me in being me. Dan loves me no matter what. And, my editor says Dan comes out as being the most lovable, incredible person in this book. So
well, he does.
I think he's looking pretty great in here. And, you know, Dan loved me before I really could love myself. We were in the same dorm, and I came out of the shower, you know, the girl's shower, with a bathrobe on, and, you know, my hair is coiled and wet. You know, he'd never ever seen me without pressed straight hair. And he comes around the corner and he sees me, and I don't have my makeup on, and I got my hair all, you know, natural and wet, and I'm mortified. It's my boyfriend. And he goes, "You have curly hair." And right. And Naveen is laughing. And I clutch my robe to myself and I say, "Yeah, because those white boys who teased me in high school, you know," and he leans toward me and he says, "I love it." And I was like, "What?" I still scurried back to my room to like do something with it. But he loved my black hair before I
That's a nice story. Yeah, it's a nice story. Anyone have questions? If so, there is a microphone back there, and we don't see anyone. Don't be shy. Come on, this is. Here's somebody coming now. Go.
Can anybody hear me?
Okay, you have a sign stuck to you. Is that Bernadette Chi?
Feel free.
Hello. There we go. Okay, now we've got some questions.
All right. And before you, before those, as you line up to ask your questions, just let me just give you one little reminder. I was a judge for almost 19 years, and so sometimes lawyers had a tendency to just run off and talk and talk and talk. So I had the rule of the three B's in my courtroom, and let's be clear, be brief, be seated. So let's we'll follow the three B's here tonight. All right,
great
go right ahead.
Thank you both for being here tonight and for just speaking with such honesty and clarity around the experiences. Julie, Dean Julie, I'm wondering if you could bring together sort of the, all the work you did on how to parent, right? And how to speak to children, their parents, in this very challenge. I'm finding it very challenging to parent during this time when I feel like there are so many of these cuts, microaggressions that are happening all over. How can we as parents speak to our young, our children growing up about how to be good allies to those who are being attacked or feeling not welcomed? Or if you have a child who does feel attacked or unwelcomed, how do you, what would you say parents should say to their kids so that we can ensure that they don't lose that sense of self-love and as they move out into the, you know, unfortunately, feeling uncaring world?
Thank you so much, my friend. Appreciate the question. One of the things we do when we overparent is we try to shield kids from painful things, try to experiences their, handle their emotions for them, solve and smooth it for them, instead of letting them, as Brené Brown would say, you know, sit with their sadness and their grief and their unhappiness. Brené Brown, who writes about vulnerability, says, you know, I cannot heal it. I cannot fix it for you, but I can sit with you in it and experience it. And I think we have to be able to do that as parents. For a child who has experienced something awful, what we need is to help that child have agency in their lives and around that circumstance. We do a lot of discounting and not believing of kids who come from marginalized communities. Did it really happen the way you think it happened? Was it really that bad, right? We do that for all kinds of, with respect to all kinds of identities and experiences. And what we need to be doing as parents is to be listening to our children and believing our children and advocating for our children. We all need, when we go through difficult things, we need allies to believe us and to flank us, which means, you know, someone who will stand with us as we are trying to stand strong ourselves. The older our kids get, the more, you know, they are able to stand on their own two feet and be supported by us. When they're very little, we need to be the ones really taking the lead for them. When I was in Baltimore a couple, three nights ago, I was at the Enoch Pratt Free Library, and a little white girl, age five, was there with her eight-year-old brother and her two parents, both all white. The mother is a former colleague of ours at Stanford, now lives in Baltimore. She texted me late in the night, and she said, our son had a lot of questions for us. You know, he heard me say the N-word in my reading. When I read from the book, I don't hold back, you know. And I said to the kids afterwards, you probably heard some things that might concern you, and I want you to talk with your parents about it as you go home and tonight and tomorrow. And so their eight-year-old did. Their five-year-old said, I know she was speaking to my ears, but it felt that she was speaking to my heart. A five-year-old white girl said that. And I think that is the greatest compliment I've ever received. And I share it with you to say, they are smarter than we know. They are more intuitive than we know. They're not born racist. You know, they're born compassionate beings. You know, let us not let our children lose that. Let us not let the world harden them or make them indifferent to suffering. You know, we want to raise young humans to be compassionate toward others. So we have to dare to have these conversations. Just like when someone dies, we don't want to talk to our kids about it because we think they can't handle it. You know who can't handle it?
We can't handle it. So in these difficult conversations about race, we have to get over our own feelings of worry and inadequacy and dare to speak to our children as the humans they are and dare to help them understand the values that we have and that we hold dear so that they can go out into this world and make it a better place.
Especially so, given the world as it is now.
Absolutely.
That's the world. Next question.
We're going to take these two questions.
All right. We have two questions and then we'll wrap up.
Hi, Julie. Thanks for sharing the embrace that you felt when you were at that graduation. And it's fucked up that it took that long in your life for you to feel, you know?
Yes.
So I'm here with some of my other teacher colleagues, and I want my students to feel what you felt on that stage at a much earlier time in their life, hopefully. And so I was just wondering if you, you know, as a teacher, how could we have our kids feel that? Yeah, through the school system.
Beautiful question. Well, I think teachers will have a better sense of the answer than I do. But here's, I'll just sort of hazard a guess. I was able to come to that epiphany in part because I was doing so much work around self-love. I had finally said out loud to myself, or was in the process of saying, I was ashamed to be Black. You know, I was a little afraid of Black people. That was my truth as a young Black child with no Black people around and only the media to feed me with its racism, okay? So as I summoned that truth that I was ashamed of, myself and my people, to consciousness, then that fear began to loosen its grip on me. And I was then able to be someone who could see myself amid Blackness and love Black people. So it was a very complex process, journey toward loving myself. And in some ways, and I think time is part of this, and maybe the inevitability of time is there. But for students who have the benefit of being in community with mentors and teachers who have walked that journey or a similar journey, see those kids, mentor those kids, talk with them about your lived experience as a person of color. Ask them to write about their experiences. Ask them to share. Give them opportunities and venues for them to share their work and their truth. I didn't think my experiences mattered to anybody, so I never talked about them until I was 39 or 40 years old. You know, if there had been more opportunities, more people interested in the truth of my American experience, I think I would have gotten there sooner. And every teacher can help a young person become familiar with themselves and discover that that self is lovable, loved, and matters.
Great.
All right, this is our final audience question.
Hi. So I'd like for you to, first I want to thank both of you for coming out and talking about this very sensitive subject at times. As an African-American woman, I have been shunned by both communities, Black and white, never Black enough, never white enough, didn't fit in.
Yeah.
Rarely do I still fit in. So I just, by the time I got to college, I just said, you know what, I'm just going to be the introvert that I am and be okay with it. But I'm raising a young lady now who is 17, and I sent her to a fabulous school, probably more white than Black. In fact, it is a private school. And I'd like to speak about the cultural differences.
Can you get to your question, though? Because we're
sure. The cultural differences between raising a Black child and going against the cultural differences in the white in the white community. So, having to how are you raising your child to understand your culture that's in your home, your household, that may not mesh with the larger white community?
This is a challenge for each one of us who chooses to raise kids in communities that are not reflective of who we are and our ancestry. The first thing that I would say is, you know, with a 17-year-old, it's you've made that choice. You know, just as I've made the choice with mine to raise them in Palo Alto, I might have raised them in Berkeley or Oakland and had a better experience around their sociocultural education. So I think it is to acknowledge that the world out there is not the world in our home and try to inculcate in your child the things you believe in and expose your daughter to the issues and the people and the ideas and the values that matter to you as an African-American woman. I saw the sign saying we gotta move to the next question.
Thank you, Julie. Yeah. It is an informed tradition to ask all the speakers the following question. So, Julie, you get it. And it is, what is your 60-second idea to change the world?
I think that I have written this book to try to build compassion. I think we are suffering from a lack of compassion for anyone who's different than us. I have written about the Black experience, not the Black experience, my Black experience. With all the privilege that I have with my light skin and my upper middle class status, I have tried to tell the truth of what it has been like to be me in this America in these times. And I'm hoping that it will build, in addition to being something Black folks and biracial folks and people of color and queer folks and poor folks and immigrants and anyone who's been made to feel like the other in this country, as so many of us do, in addition to all those who I hope will nod and say, yes, she is telling some of my truth, I'm hoping folks beyond those communities will start to feel some compassion and interest in learning more about an experience that is not yours. Radical compassion is what is needed, and that takes being interested in someone else's story, listening to it, believing it, and then becoming an advocate for whatever need they might have to be more heard in this nation.
Thank you, Julie.
So,
I read Julie's book 3 times to prepare for this interview. You need only read it once to have it change your life. So Julie will be signing copies of Real American out in the lobby. Julie Lithcott-Hames, thank you for sharing your thoughts, your life, and most importantly, your heart with all of us this evening. Let's hear it for Julie Lithcott-Hames.
Thank you.